You are off the coast of Utopia. In this episode, I speak with Paul Rhodes, an American painter, writer, and composer who lives in France. Paul has a YouTube channel called Thought Thug, which discusses a variety of topics, including culture and painting, and I want to expand on some of the things he talks about. Hope you enjoy. Just a quick word about the audio quality. Initially, Paul's side has a fair amount of wind, and that soon clears up when I ask him to take care of it, so stick with it. It's a bit rough at the beginning, but clears up after a while. Thanks. All right, I'm here with Paul Rhodes. I'm speaking to him from Calgary, Alberta. He's in southern France. I'm not sure exactly where. He'll tell us. Hi, Paul.
Hi. Yeah, I'm in central western France. It's technically southern France because it's south of the Loire. So. But I'm pretty close to the Loire.
Is spring a sprung there?
Well, sort of. There's a lot of trees in bloom, but we're having some cold snaps mixed with hot weather, and everybody's got sniffles, including myself.
Yeah, we're still mirrored in winter weather here, so it is Canada after all.
Well, I grew up in New York State, so I know about it.
I know that, yeah. All right, well, I wanted to talk to different artists about basically their history, how they came to be an artist, and maybe you could start off by telling us a little bit about yourself, you know, where you're born, your childhood. Was your being an artist always something you wanted to do, and so on, and kind of how you end up in France?
Well, that's a very short version. My father's a painter, my mother's a pianist, and he had a little show at one point, and so my parents went to Mexico to stretch the money out, and I was born there. And then they moved to New York. And so I grew up really in the art scene, even as a little kid. And I wanted to be a painter, even when I was 3 and 4, in imitation of my father. So that's something I realized. My whole experience as a kid in New York, I later realized was quite important, because very few people my age had that experience. You had to be older to have had it, to have seen the emergence of pop art and op art and the whole contemporary thing. And then I always wanted to be kind of a traditional painter. My father was more of a surrealist, he did traditional paintings, but he also did expressionism, which was the big thing back then. But I wanted to be a kind of traditional sort of painter, even as a little kid. And so even though I was mired in something that was always becoming more and more contemporary art, I knew that wasn't what I wanted, really.
Right.
And then I had the great good luck when I went to high school to have a wonderful teacher, Aaron Curzon, about whom I've done some videos. And I got a kind of drawing education in particular, but, you know, an artistic education, but a drawing foundation that doesn't exist anymore, as far as I can tell. And I went to 4 art schools, including the Museum School, which was the school started by Hans Hofmann. And Hans Hofmann, as I'm sure you know, was a German artist who had studied with lots of artists, including Matisse. And he started a school at which all the abstract expressionists went to. Everybody studied with Hofmann, including my high school teacher, Aaron Curzon, had also studied with Hofmann, or students of Hofmann. And so I got more of that kind of education at that school, which at the time I didn't think I really wanted, because it seemed modernist and so on. And but so then I continued on, and of course I was had no luck at all in New York. And eventually I was so disgusted with the situation, possibility of doing anything in New York, that I moved to France in my 30s.
Okay. Well, it's a There's a lot of interference with, are you walking around or is there something? Are you?
Yeah, I'm walking around.
Okay.
Well, I'm trying to keep it out of the wind. Okay.
All right. So you end up in France in your 30s, in the same place you are now, or?
Well, right around here.
Okay.
And then I married a woman a good deal older than I am, who's a painter. And she really, she was born in 1920, but she had an education. Her mother was an amateur painter, excellent. I mean, an amateur painter, like there's no professional painters today. And my wife really had been brought up in a whole 19th century way and with a painting education, because even when she was young, it was considered in France that painting education had fallen apart. And so she took a eccentric kind of track to be a more traditional kind of painter, really in a impressionist kind of mode. So that was all very interesting and enriching for me. She died a few years ago.
Oh, condolences.
Yeah, well, you know, when you die at 94 after living a happy life,
that's pretty
good.
There's
nothing to cry about.
Yeah. So did she help you kind of, did she help with your education in painting in any way?
In a certain way. I mean, I was already very formed, and I was also aiming it at certain things, which were different. But I did, yes, I was enriched by her whole approach to painting. And it was also wonderful to have her society, because it was a society that was a whole different mindset. You know, she really had attitudes from long ago, and it was very refreshing to experience that.
I bet it sounds really interesting. Can you maybe explain a little bit more what the attitudes were and how different they would have been from today even?
For one thing, to her, it was the inanity of contemporary art was just something so obvious. We didn't even need to be discussed. And so to her, painting was, you know, all the great painters. But she liked also more, liked artists like Van Dongen and Maurice Denis, she liked very much. So she wasn't closed off to aspects of modernist art, but she insisted on certain technical things. You know, she had a strong criteria of what errors were in painting and so on. And she knew how to admire painting. She knew how to judge her own painting. Mm-hmm. And it was just very down to earth. And there was nothing of the kind of vaseuse, the French word. the whole attitude that people have to adopt, you know, to sort of accept what's going on and bend their principles and be falsely tolerant of things. She had none of that. She was a complete straight shooter.
Sounds great.
Yeah, it was really great. Refreshing is what it was. It's
right.
Just healthy and refreshing.
So you've been in France for 30 plus years then?
Well, yeah, it's I guess it's 28 years now.
28, okay.
Yeah. And I where I live here, that there was a little, it wasn't even a gallery, it was more of a framing shop that did gallery business. And I was able to make a living as a painter. The woman who ran it has retired now, but for a long time, I made my living as a painter. It was great. And it wasn't tourists or anything who bought my paintings. It was the local people. So,
okay.
A town of about 10,000. So that worked out for me.
That sounds all right, yes. So maybe we can talk a little bit about your painting. You know, what your early kind of ideas were, how those have changed, what your future kind of goals are with painting.
Yeah, when I was, at first, my idea, I admired great painting. I learned to love great painting. My first in with great paintings, probably Watteau. And then I became very excited about Fragonard and discovered Tintoretto and so on. But my own painting was very often, I tried to do paintings from imagination and compositions. And I got my old drawings recently from America, and I see these tons of drawings where I was trying to do compositions and so on. I've forgotten about a lot of that. But mostly I worked from a model, a lot of landscapes. I did a great deal of landscape painting, but you know, I loved painting portraits. I painted a lot of portraits and still lives, everything. But I always wanted to move towards painting where I was less dependent on what I was looking at. And my teacher, Aaron Kurzen, was insistent on that. He talked a lot about that, about avoiding having painting be too illustrative, too much dependent on the subject. And Genevieve's painting was that. I mean, she always had a subject. And she always wanted a certain kind of subject because she did her painting, though at the end it moved towards old masterish kind of painting. I mean, she always, when she made her portrait, she always had reproductions of Van Dyck and Titian open. So she could look at that, and her late portraits are quite amazing. But so I slowly started figuring out ways to create paintings without having the thing in front of me, doing drawing studies and memorizing colors and so on, but then using more and more of my imagination. And then in the last...
Did you have some models for specificity, let's say, or was it...
In 2000 and what was it? 2006-07 around then. I sold some paintings. I made a bunch of money, and I used it to have models. I made a bunch of nudes.
Mm-hmm. But are those the ones you put up
already? Some of them. Some of
those nice
nudes I've shown on YouTube. But then when I did some of my more recent, even though I haven't been able to do a lot of painting in the last 10 years, but my baptism or my Europa, they're done without my, though sometimes, I mean, I might do some sketches here or there for some drawings or something to get myself out of some confusion or something. But you know, at this point, after all the training I had, life drawing and everything I've done, I can create figures without a model, even though I might look at something to help along at some point.
Right. That's very much the opposite of what's happening now, I think, in, as you discussed, in kind of this revival of classical painting, whereas there's a lot of looking at the model and a lot of, you know, just basically copying the model, which is kind of the other end of the spectrum, right? I think great art has got to have a little bit of both. It's got to be somewhere in the middle, either a little bit more conceptual or a little bit, perhaps a little bit more realistic. But we're kind of at this, seems to be going more and more extreme, where it's just this specificity, this exactness, you know.
It's not a question of looking at the model. It's a question of the paintings being related to visual experience. So, for instance, paintings of people. The danger of having a model. You know, I love this quotation from Delacroix, who said the only draftsmen who can, or painters who can get any benefit from a model are those who don't need one. And that's a great thing, because it's that's where freedom is. You have to have a certain mastery. A painting is, in a certain way, a creation. But when it's just abstraction, it's not really painting anymore. I mean, that's a whole big thing of mine. This the famous, what I call the early modern analysis of painting, whereby they criticized illustrative painting and, by implication, abstract painting, saying that there's a decorative side and there's an illustrative side. And that using models is a different thing. I mean, you can use models or not use models, but you should, a painter should be free to not use the model so that they can then benefit from the model.
Right.
Because if you look at any of the great painters, they're always abstracting, as the word used to be used. In other words, they're being inspired by, if you're talking about figure painting, they're being inspired by the reality of the human body, but they're not just copying what it looks like at a given moment. I mean, you take Michelangelo. It's completely unrealistic. It's all full of anatomy, and it's also convincing, but it's also a fantasy. And the same with all the great painters, to a greater or lesser extent. With Velázquez, it's a lesser extent, but there's other, he doesn't, he's less adventurous with forms, but he does wonderful things with color, for instance, don't really come out of reality, making these silvery skin tones and so on. So,
yeah. This is a really interesting topic, because it's something that, is missing, I think, in the training of a lot of contemporary realist painters. If you look at all the greats, and we see Michelangelo, we see Titian, we see, Velázquez, and we want to emulate them, but then we're often so tied to this the model that we often forget, that we have to invent or abstract or idealize forms and how to do that, And that's, I think, where comic book artists are really do interesting things, and modern illustrators have some of that. So it's like the whole painting genre is just kind of broken up into little pieces.
Yeah.
And everyone's doing one specific thing. No one's kind of doing everything. what I mean? So.
Yeah. There used to be something called the grand manner. And that implied treating the figure a certain way. And Rubens wrote a treatise. I don't know if you know it. It's called it's about the human figure. I've got it here somewhere. Here it is. What's it called? A theory of the human figure considered in its principles, either in repose or in movement. And you would think that would be about constructing the figure, but it's not. It's about the character that a body should be given. And for instance, one example is like if you want to paint Jesus, and according to Rubens, you have to be, on the one hand, there's the Zeus kind of figure, this tremendous, powerful, godlike figure, and he compares it to the bull. It has to be bull-like, and he draws these pictures going from the bull to this bull-like human. And then there's the Apollo, a much more poetic, slender figure. And it's like a deer or something. And then the Christ figure, according to Rubens, should be between the two. And then he shows how to build up that figure. But it's not about how to construct the thing. It's about the feeling it should have. So that's where they were at. That's an aspect of the grand manner, how things should be exaggerated, how things should be exalted, how things should be given a grand simplicity.
Is that available in English? Because I've only seen it in French.
Well, I have it in French. It's probably, the original is probably in Latin.
Yeah, because it's actually that you can find it online, just on archive. Yeah. But it's a French version, so.
Yeah. Well, you have to know French. It's like knowing Portuguese.
I probably can figure it out between the Italian and the Portuguese. You probably can figure out some of it anyways, but.
Yeah, that's right. No, I realized what an idiot I was until I learned French. It's amazing what a language opens up for one. You know?
Yeah, it gives you different ways of expressing yourself. There's things ways of right. being in one language that you just can't be in another language.
Exactly right. It's amazing.
Yeah, yeah. I've had people comment that my personality changes when I'm in Italy, so.
Yeah, That's right.
All right, well, if we can, I guess, back onto to painting.
Yeah.
So what are, I guess, some of your goals right now with what you're doing after having kind of a hiatus from painting, as you had said?
Well, it's not a hiatus, really. I've been interrupted because I had to take care of my wife so much. Mm-hmm. And for that, I couldn't leave her side for a long time. I had other duties like that made it so I didn't do much painting. I kept doing some painting. And then for the last 2 years, I've been painting the ceiling, a decorated ceiling, which I'm now putting up, and that's going to take another month or so. But meanwhile, what I want to do is I want to paint large paintings. I'm working on a crucifixion. I've started a crucifixion. I've showed it a little bit in a few YouTube things.
Yes,
and I've got a few other large. You saw that?
Yeah, I'd seen that, and I it was interesting because I was teaching a workshop at the time, and you're kind of approaching it the exact way I was teaching my students.
So. Oh yeah.
That was really, really you interesting. Mentioned that. You know, slightly different in the fact that, you know, we're working slightly different, but the concepts, the way of thinking, the process is more or less the same. So that was interesting to see. That more of that uh-huh. stuff, I think, would be really interesting to see as well. So,
well, if I keep doing YouTube and I keep doing things, I can filter that out. But yeah, it's a. How would you define those principles?
Not so much the principles, I guess, as the technical approach. You know. You're working very loosely at the beginning, you know, blocking in the big colors very simply, you know, going from very, very big and grand to more specific as you work, you know, very simply to more specific. You know, these principles are things that I learned at the Angel Academy. And, you know, try to pass on as well to my students. Again, it's just a slightly different approach. The main thing I think being is this being tied to the model
a bit
too much. So one just has to train oneself to invent figures.
Yeah.
Or, you know,
that's really what drawing education to my mind should be geared towards. It wasn't in the education I got, but it could have been. And you can study anatomy a little bit and memorize them in anatomy, and then learn the real principles of drawing, getting strongly expressing the forms in the space in a simple way.
Yeah, I mentioned as a comment in one of your videos that I've done several workshops with Glenn Vilppu, who teaches that approach, you know, talking about looking at the model, using the model, not copying the model, but using it as a guide for what you're doing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, again, these principles they're out there. They're just all broken up and separate. So trying to gather them all up under one umbrella of teaching is something that would be something to work towards, especially for younger students, you know?
Oh, yeah. Well, then there's something else, which to me is the most important thing, which is
the principles of composition. And this was always been a big question in my life. And the answers that I found always seemed to me to be woefully inadequate. You know, things have to be balanced, blah, 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 this sort of thing. It's and then I feel like I finally unearthed important principles by studying Boucher and Canaletto that have to do with dramatizing space and the relationship between the flat and the depth. In other words, the relationship between the decorative and the illustrative, the relationship between the surface and the illusion. And there's principles governing these things that they're natural things. They're just there, and you can feel them. But you can also eventually understand them and manipulate them more fluidly with one's mind, and therefore apply them in an integrated manner with everything.
That's interesting. Can you expound on that a little bit?
Well,
is it hard to do without pictures?
Well, I can. It's very simple things, really. But the doing it, for me at least, integrating it into my practice has been very, very difficult. But the basic ideas are very simple. If you have an element in the painting, which could be, say, a linear element, something that's, you know, something, an arm or something that's prolonged by something else. Let's say it's a silhouette of a tree or whatever it is. Or if you have an area, let's say an area of what? Something in the foreground, whatever it is, you know, like anything. Some area that has a certain color or a certain value. And then you have something that prolongs it, that's next to it, that's the same color and the same value, but that is farther off in the space. So you have an element, a linear element or an area element, which is both, which on the surface, it's just a line or a linear thing, or it's an area. But in space, it's both near and far. And that's a very, very important thing, because that's something that jogs the mind into feeling the magic of painting. Because here's something that's on the surface. There it is. It's patches of paint. But at the same time, it's an illusion. It's far near. Now, if you have something just cut out, you know, that's supposed to be near, okay, you're getting a little bit of the illusion, but when it gets all integrated with these kinds of things where the far and near is connected on the surface.
Right, okay.
So, see what I'm saying?
So as a shape, say as a flat shape, it sits together, but yet as an illusionistic element, it reaches being as receding into the distance?
That's it.
Okay, yeah.
It's near and it's far. And this becomes, this sort of thing is then integrated with forms. You know, any painting has a dance of forms and shapes that are on the surface and in space. And if you look at Boucher, he does this to me in the way that's the most lucid. You see right away, if you're looking for that, any Boucher will right away show you this dance of forms and shapes and areas, which are on the surface and in space and all dancing together in a kind of organized way that gives it a sort of power that illustrative, what I call just illustrative painting, doesn't have.
Boucher is definitely somebody that's not in fashion right now, isn't he?
Oh, no, he's never been in fashion. But to me, he's always been like, you know, in the 18th century, he was it. He was the head of the academy. He was the guy. I mean, he completely dominated painting for his whole lifetime, really.
I was just at the Getty Museum. They have some really big Bouchers there, actually.
Uh-huh.
I was thinking about you when I was looking at them. Think, okay, I got to study these a bit more.
Yeah, so he was dismissed. I mean, even by painters for whom I have tremendous respect and were great influences on me when I was a kid. It just no one was interested. But he has that. And I mean, I also like Boucher. I like the imagery. I like the whole spirit of it. So that's something else. You can just look at it technically. And technically, it's astonishing. And he simplifies everything. And he makes this wonderful thing. And wow, he does so many things. But that's it. Getting towards the kind of mastery that's close to that. It doesn't necessarily have to be in that super organized 18th century way. But those principles, you find them in all great painting. Even if it's in a more rustic or more sort of manly, casual way.
Would you say that his kind of style or brand of painting is something that the early modernists were looking at, in the sense of trying to get back to painting and away from this?
I don't think they were looking at that at all, but I think it's a profound influence that they were feeling. I mean, there's a direct line from Boucher up to modernist painting, because Ingres was a student of David, and David was a student of Boucher. If you look at early Davids, they look like Bouchers. And so David, I've got this whole theory, art history theory, that David's painting started tilting towards illustrative painting because of his involvement in the French Revolution, where everything had to serve the revolution. And of course, he's a great, great painter, but I think that gave an impulse towards painting, which you feel a little bit more in Ingres, even though Ingres is a great painter, a wonderful, inventive painter. But then when you get to the students of Ingres, here you can start talking about Bouguereau, then the illustrative aspect of painting starts being triumphant. And this, to me, was where the modernists made their reaction. And to me, the example there's several examples, but the example of Puvis de Chavannes is very important, because Puvis, he went back to Poussin. Mm-hmm. And Poussin, in a way, is the fountainhead of French painting, which comes out of the Roman school. He went back to a consciousness of the surface. And that gave a whole new impulse to painting, which was very fruitful. And then, of course, it all broke down. I mean, all painting totally broke down by the 20th century. It just, and then by the 60s, it was all gone.
But. Right. I'm curious about going back to the idea about David changing his style to suit the revolution. Do you mean becoming a little bit more illustrative in that sense?
Well, yeah,
shifting towards the illustrative?
Well, yeah, because painting, it was no longer about so much about painting and being this glorious thing, but it was about serving the revolution. And therefore, it becomes, when painting is serving something else, then it's the illustrative aspect that's useful.
Right.
No, okay. You're not going to, the fancy dance of shapes and forms of Boucher is not useful to revolutionaries. No, they don't give a damn about that. They want to show hero work of the revolution and so on.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
And so if you look at late David, I mean, even, you know, any painting by David is a masterpiece. But if you compare particularly late David, even the, well, including very much the coronation of Napoleon, for instance, and you compare it to, say, his earlier work, or you compare it to, say, Boucher, it's not so concerned with that. The great concern is glorifying Napoleon. I mean, he's still involved with painting. He's a great painter. You can't get away from that. But you can see the tendency, and you can see it in anger. Wonderful. But then, I don't know. Do you get to New York much?
Not as much as I'd like to. I was there a couple of years back.
Well, I don't know. You know, the last time I was there, anyway, the way they had it hung, they've got that pair of man and wife portraits by Angle in a room, and there's also a little Delacroix. I don't know if you noted that, but I mean, those Angles are astonishing, just astonishing. These two big portraits, and then there's this little Delacroix of a head, of his mother or something, somebody like that.
What museum is this at?
And in the Met.
Okay, in the Met. Yeah.
In the Met. And, you know, and just to me, as astonishing and wonderful as the angle is, the Delacroix puts them in shadow. You know, because the quality of the effect in the Delacroix becomes secondary, and there's this other thing going on. I don't know how to talk about it at the moment, but there's
you know, it's always hard to talk about visual things with words, right?
You mentioned about talking about painting, and I quoted my father, who always said when they would ask about painting, he said, well, if I could describe it, if I could say it, I'd say it. I would make a painting.
Exactly, yeah. That's always got me, because I did a fine arts degree at a modern university, so you know, you have to write about your painting, and I always thought this is just the most ridiculous thing, because you know, you have to have your artist statement. And well,
yeah. When was that? Pictures. When did you?
80 in yeah. the '80s, yeah.
In the '80s, yeah. Well, you. I feel like I was very lucky that I really caught the last end of a certain kind of education. It was the last scrap of it. And I didn't know how to appreciate it at the time, but later I realized.
Yeah, that's common. I mean, you were lucky to be in a place that was a center, right? Of our, you know, we had some very good teachers here, but, you know, we're very much back in the 70s and 80s, Calgary was far away from everything, so.
Oh, so that was in Calgary where you were?
Yeah, yeah. You know, I was very much interested in the great painters, but nobody really could teach that. You know, I asked some of my professors about process, and they just didn't have much of an idea of that.
Well, already in the '70s, it was the only, you know, it was abstract painting. That was the only thing. I mean, there's a few little painters left, a little bit, and there were still some drawing courses. But drawing had been banned in the French Academy in the 60s.
Yeah, those are the dark days.
And they only brought it back in the 90s. I remember the debates they had on the radio about that, justifying drawing. But of course, the drawing that they teach now in France at the Academy, to me, it's not even drawing. It's just, you know, fiddling around.
Yeah, the universities still have that mentality, you know, it still hasn't gone away, you know, so that's why we've got all these ateliers popping up everywhere. And
yeah,
kind of reconstructing this old
except
art form.
To me, I mean, I know what goes on in Jacob Collins's school. Mm-hmm. And to me, it's, you know, it's not really drawing. I mean, I don't want to be insulting about it or anything, but it's not anything that I don't think they even would have really recognized as a proper drawing education, even in the 19th century French Academy.
What do you think is missing from, let's just even say from the 19th century French Academy? Because we've talked about how early artists conceptualized a lot more, you know, like the figures of Michelangelo and
yeah, I mean, they invented it was and they invented in a certain direction. It wasn't just gratuitous weirdness, you know, like a painter like what's his name, John Cullen, or
oh yeah, something like that. Yeah, yes, I know who you're talking about.
Curran.
Yeah, John Curran. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, there, you know, there's a ton of artists like that. Just a ton. I mean, he's probably one of the best ones. I mean, Odd Nerdrum is a little like that, really.
Odd Nerdrum.
Yeah, Nerdrum. Yeah. Whatever it is. And the idea of these weird fantasy kind of things. And people take that to be expression. Whereas if you take a painter like, you know, I don't know, Veronese, you don't have that kind of fantasy. It's another kind of fantasy. That's a real painting kind of fantasy. It's not about a sort of mood or a sort of surrealist feeling about things. It's about how the forms are, and the forms are magnificent. They're simple and powerful, and they're moving around. That's the kind of fantasy that's proper to painting, or I don't know. There's so many artists, Ricci, and so much invention.
Yeah, Odd does talk about, you know, making the figures spiritual. I think a lot of his kind of distortion or invention comes from the subject matter.
Yeah.
But some of the figures where he's trying to be a little bit, say less, where the subject matter is not so provocative, his figures are definitely more spiritual. He talks about, you know, elongating the figure and making the head small and the hands slightly big. So these kind of simple things that people don't even do in you know, the contemporary realist painting. He's at least talking about these things and talking
well,
about...
Well, yeah, but John Curran does that too.
Yes, yeah, he does. A different effect, but yeah.
Well, to me, it's in the same world of effect. It's not... See, that grand manner, it's common to all the painters. It's you go from Titian and Raphael right up to Delacroix and Moreau. And
how is that different from what they're doing, in your opinion? Like, what's missing? And
it's not about weirdness. It's not about mocking weirdness.
Right.
It's always about something essential about human aspiration, something higher. It's expressing something higher and something that's, how shall I put it? I mean, you can do so many things with painting. You can do these weird things with painting, but it's, I don't know that. It's a kind of simplicity that lends itself to spreading colors on the canvas. You know, and not this, well, I mean, then you could say, well, you know, there's the northern painters and it's all this little squiggly stuff. It's true. I mean, there's room in painting for everything. So, but there's the grand painters that we admire most of all. And they were always involved in this higher thing, which had no mockery in it and had no...
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
There's nothing postmodernist about it.
Yeah, so their aspiration is more towards making things, well, the beautiful, I guess, and the good and the true.
Yeah. But that has a concrete graphic expression. Mm-hmm. It has something simple and grand about it. It's in the colors. It's in everything.
Who are your, I mean, outside of Boucher, the painters you're looking at most?
Oh, well, I mean, I guess, I mean, I love all the great painters. I love absolutely all the great painters. But I guess my special loves would be, say, Fragonard and Tintoretto and Guardi, probably.
Yeah, Tintoretto is great. But, very powerful.
Oh, Tintoretto, oh, wow. But, you know, I love all the great painters.
All right, let's shift gears a little bit, maybe.
Yeah.
We can talk about, something that you talk about on your videos, kind of the floundering of Western civilization, the loss of culture. I mean, I'm thinking not necessarily to get into that to be negative, more about how someone that is interested in educating themselves in the greatness of the West, what, in your opinion, would they do as far as what books should they read, should they become familiar with, just to start in a self-education?
Yeah. Well, I would say it's not just books. Well, people should listen to music and look at paintings. Yeah. People should go to the museum and find their way into painting. I mean, I think of myself, how I found my way. When I was a little kid, I loved Monet. And the Met, when I would go to the Met, where I went all the time as a little kid, you know, when I was 7 and 8, I would go by myself. And my favorite painting was Moreau, the Oedipus. But then a few years later, I guess I was about 15, I discovered Watteau. And Watteau was my way into the whole thing. So I found something that opened up everything for me. And then there's music. You know, people should, you have to get to the point where you realize what an absolutely wonderful thing Così fan tutte is, you know, of Mozart. you've got to get there. And you've got to get there somehow. And you have to work your way into these things. But then my way into the greatness of, you know, the great Western things was Plato. And reading certain, I think the Meno was the first dialogue I read. And the Apology and so on, which they're not very long things. But these are, the main thing is not some specific thing, but getting into it so that it opens up. It opens up for you, and then you can expand. It's endless. You know, Jane Austen. You gotta get into these things so that they become the world for you, because they are the world. This world we admire in great painting. It's all, you know, the Bible, the whole thing.
Just start with Plato and
well, or find something that speaks to you as a way of, each person is going to be different. That was my thing when I was a kid. It was also, it depended on the age I had, I suppose.
Right. Yeah. I'm just thinking it's kind of for someone that's maybe younger, that's, you know, studying at one of these schools and wants to discover more. You know.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I think it's quite astonishing that Jordan Peterson is getting everyone to read Nietzsche.
Yeah. It's,
you know, suddenly people, which it seems to me a kind of crazy place to start, because Nietzsche is, I don't know. I mean, I watch PewDiePie. I don't know if you watch PewDiePie.
No.
But PewDiePie, everyone told him, I guess there must have been Jordan Peterson people, told him to read Beyond Good and Evil. So he read Beyond Good and Evil, and he talked about it, and he said that, you know, he was lost because he didn't know what the hell Nietzsche was referring to in the first 100 pages or something. And so, you know, Nietzsche is not, it seems to me, not a logical place to start. But if that works for people, if that gets them going, because Nietzsche is so much about being against Socrates and being against Jesus. And that's interesting if you know
really what he's arguing against. If you really have had an experience with Socrates, for instance, mm-hmm. and Jesus, I mean, Socrates is so lovable. You read Plato, you fall in love with Socrates. And then Nietzsche's attacking Socrates. unless you can be indignant against Nietzsche for doing that, I don't know what it means. But you know, I don't know. The one knows what these great books are, and certain, like, for instance, I had a big experience with Xenophon. I love Xenophon. I think everybody should read Jack Vance.
Oh yes, that's what you had said. I bought one of his books, the one you recommended. Was it
I don't know,
the first one?
I recommend them all. No, I mean, to me, Jack Vance is a really great writer. It's not.
I'd never heard of him before. You?
Yeah. Well, I mean, so to me, it's it's on the level of Jane Austen.
And he's a science fiction writer, mostly. You could talk about him a little bit.
He's considered a science fiction writer. He wanted to be a writer. When he was a kid, he wrote poetry all the time, and then he tried to be. He tried to be a fantasy writer. He tried to be a mystery writer. He wrote 15 mysteries. But he eventually he had success as in science fiction. But very quickly, his science fiction became something else. But he was always published as science fiction, and he never really got to the, science fiction readers don't really want what he's giving them. So he never got super, super popular, even though in the science fiction community, he's a tremendous influence. It's probably among important science fiction writers, more people are influenced by Jack Vance. I mean, he's infinitely beyond all these people as a writer. He's a great artist. And
it's Whist is the one that I bought.
Oh, well, Whist. Yeah, sure. I mean, they're all great. They're all great. It's not really about painting, but the main character is someone who wants to be a painter and who paints.
Oh, okay. It's on my list.
Yeah, it's a political book. It's a wonderful, I mean, that's a book that you could sweep away practically all of university courses about political philosophy and replace it with study of that book. And you'd get a better result.
It's pretty high praise.
It tells you everything you need to know about the contemporary political dilemma. The basics of it. Then you have to read Cadwalladr for more specifics about what's going on today.
And when was his active period?
Well, he died. He stopped writing in the late 90s. Well, probably around, let's see. He finished his last book in the early 90s. No, is that it? Yeah. Yeah, probably about 94 or something like that.
Okay.
And then he lived until 97, I think. No, or more than that. I don't know. He lived on, but he was blind and he couldn't write anymore. It was terrible.
And he's American?
An American. He's from California. He was during the war, he was on a Liberty ship, attacked by submarines, and he then became a sailor. And then after that, he worked as a carpenter. He worked as a carpenter into his 50s before he started making enough money as a writer. But he was quite prolific. And I got to know him, and I published a complete edition of his work, which was a huge thing. But I have boundless admiration for him. I've read everything, I don't know, 10 times. No, I mean, it's so great. So that's some living art, if you like. It's really, really worthwhile.
So something that's definitely in the tradition, but of our time, is that a good take on it?
Huh?
Something that's in the great tradition, but of our time?
Well, Yeah, I mean, to me, tradition, that's a complicated thing. I mean, to the extent that tradition means a certain style or something, no, because Watteau is so different from, say, Renaissance painting, but there's a great relationship between right. Watteau and Michelangelo, say, for instance. Or you can say things like that. And it's in those connections that the tradition, in quote, resides. In other words, what's really important, what's really living in these things. And then they have an outer expression, which you can take it or leave it. But the inner core of what makes those things so terrific is where I place the tradition. And those things to me are something real and alive. They're not, it's not like a cultural tradition. It's like the reality of the thing.
Right.
And
more like the
and
soul.
So these different art. Huh?
This is kind of like the soul.
Yeah. The living reality. So that it's, to me, the great, each artist is like giving us a view into this eternal living thing. And that can clue us in to how we ourselves might participate in that and not just be caught up in some fashion or some transient, not something that's not so eternal. I'm big on eternity.
Well, yeah, that I think as painters, that's you want your work to be both of its time, but also eternal, right? You don't want to have to be in fashion, because that's fashion is say something that's so awful it has to be changed every 6 months.
That's it. That's it. And you also want to do something that, that has some kind of permanent value. And so one has to free oneself of the prejudices of one's time, that's for sure.
Yes.
And when I was young, the prejudice was in favor of modernist art. And there was a big prejudice which I didn't share. And now the prejudice is in favor of what I consider very illustrative art. And I don't share that either. And so it's nice to live way out in the middle of nowhere here, so I don't have to be pestered too much.
Well, you want to make sure that you get away, too, to get some inspiration, right?
Yeah.
Otherwise, you can become too mired in your own processes, I suppose, in a sense.
Yeah, that's right. And that's why it's valuable to converse, and it's valuable to have one's ideas challenged and so on. But not for the sake of something homogenous, but for the sake of sharpening the ideas.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd written something in response to one of my comments on a video. Technology has unleashed the untamed psyche on social organization.
I said that?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, because technology is power. And power is wealth. And wealth is leisure. And leisure is the freedom to do what we want. So if what you want is just to eat and satisfy other base needs, then right away you plunge into decadence. You plunge, the people who don't have the soul of the seeker or the warrior, whatever, however you want to put it, are in danger when they're empowered of becoming gluttonous plutocrats, and that's the psyche that's unleashed, the unelevated psyche, and that's where we're at, because
because that's the way the world is. Most people, probably everybody, to some degree or another, it's hard to be your own disciplinarian, to be your own rule. And so when people gain, you know, kids, they've got money, they've got independence, they can do whatever they want, they do all sorts of things that kids never used to do, they follow their bliss. And, you know, the ecologists want to plunge us back into the Middle Ages, and I think it's deplorable, but probably from a moral point of view, it'll probably do most people a lot of good.
good point.
I hate to say it because I'm in favor of, I want freedom for myself. So it would be nasty of me to not want freedom for other people. So I do want freedom for other people. But obviously some people misuse the freedom. There's a great deal of misuse of freedom, as there always is, of course.
Yeah. I mean, you know, they talk about freedom as being, you know, just being able to do what you want to do, but that's not really true freedom. You know, is the ability to make the right choices when there's unlimited freedom, or when there's unlimited choices, right? So, you know, we have to be re-educated or re-educate ourselves from what the society teaches us, and that can be very difficult.
We have to want something. You've got to want something. You got to want something else. And, you know, that brings us right to contemporary art, which is all about cultivating the base instincts, cultivating, you know, exploring the muck in your own psyche. And that's a terrible thing, rather than, you know, the Jordan Petersonian thing, cleaning it up.
Yeah.
and it's the surrealist thing about drawing. The idea that any kind of education or formation is going to rob you of your creativity. And there's a grain of truth in it, but you have to go through that discipline to get to real freedom. It's a danger. It is a danger, education. You become formatted. And you see that in academia all the time. Look at all these professors. They all talk in the same way, and the vast, vast majority of them say the same things and think the same things. They're all programmed. But, you know, if you don't have some real education, if you haven't passed through the gauntlet a little bit, if you haven't subjected yourself to something, then you can't develop any strength and then stand up yourself and do something and say something. So it's a dilemma. Things aren't easy, you know. Life is hard, but that hard aspect is where the good stuff is. So that's what it is.
That's a very good point. Yeah. Well, do you want to wrap it up there, or do you have anything you want to add?
No, this has been a lot of fun. We didn't talk about Bouguereau. We need to argue about Bouguereau. We'll do that another time.
We can do that when we get Mike Sass on. How about that?
Yeah. Yeah, that'll be great. Okay, yeah.
Okay, well, it's been a really great, it's just over an hour, so it's a good amount of time. Thanks very much.
Well, thank you, Mark.
We're going to end this episode with one of Paul's compositions, Variation number 6 on Je m'appelle Helene, played by Suzanne Fournier.